Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. If you've been home a lot lately, you've probably had a lot of time to think about money. And if you've had some free time, and some people have, you might be considering taking part in an online money course. There's courses in everything. Money's certainly a part of that. We're going to talk to personal finance expert Leslie Ann Scorgi about what makes a money program work, how to choose the best one for your specific financial situation. Now, one of the questions you might be asking yourself when it comes to finances is whether you have a productive relationship with your money. Ken Honda is the author of a book called Happy Money, The Japanese Art of Making Peace with Your Money. And he's going to be here with us from Tokyo to talk about his book and how to tell us to choose happy. Then using artificial intelligence and social media to get investment insights. That is the goal of Buzz Indexes. Its founder, Jamie Wise, is here to tell us about the process that they go through to assemble that index and some of the top companies that people are feeling good about right now. Going through a divorce, people don't feel good about that. But there are so many financial considerations. We're going to talk to Russell Alexander. He is the founder of Russell Alexander Collaborative Family Lawyers, and he's got a book called Everything You've Always Wanted to Know About Divorce. Plus, little kicker here, we're going to talk about music royalty business. Anthony Bruno from Royalty Exchange will be here to tell you how you can buy a bit of Drake, just a little bit of Drake, the royalty stream from Drake. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Let's get started. No matter what your financial situation is, how can you create a life of abundance by changing your relationship with money? This is the question that's explored in Ken Honda's book, Happy Money, The Japanese Art of Making Peace with Your Money. He joins us now from Tokyo, Japan, to talk more about the book and how you can choose happy money. Hello there, and thank you for getting up at 4 a.m. to talk to us. We appreciate
it. Hello, Bruce. Hey, hi, this is Ken Honda. I just woke up early, and I'm so excited. This is a beautiful way of starting my day in Tokyo.
Fantastic. Now, you begin the book with this amazing story about someone looking through your wallet, and they were looking to see if your money was smiling. What does that even mean? How could she tell? And what was the answer?
I was at the party in Tokyo and she approached me. At the time, you know, magazine article, they were focusing on what kinds of wallets celebrities do have, you know. Wouldn't that be interesting to see what Justin Bieber and all those celebrities, you know, do they even have a wallet? So, okay. And I told her, as long as you give it back to me, you can take a look at my wallet. And she pulled out all the bills and she was checking something. And she was saying, this is okay. This is great. This is wonderful. And she put back all the bills and gave it back to me. And I asked her, what are you doing? And she said, I was checking if I could see you're okay. And Ken, you're good to go. And I asked her, what am I good to go? It sounds good. But what is it? She said, you must have made a lot of people smile and happy. That's why all the bills in your wallet are smiling. And I still didn't get it. And she said, I'm psychic and I see things that other people don't see. And she says, if you're making people happy and receive money, your money is smiling in your wallet. And if you're taking advantage of other people, or do the work that you don't like and get money, your money is crying or getting upset in your wallet. And I thought it's interesting. And I started to wonder what kinds of money is in my friend's wallet. And I had so much fun thinking, even thinking about it. That's the story goes.
Wow. I can imagine some of our listeners are like, that is a little too woo-woo for
me.
But it's an amazing part of your journey and your book is fascinating. You use a phrase called happy money. How do you define that phrase and what are some examples of it?
Happy money makes you smile when you receive it. When you make money, you just receive money from your clients and companies, and if you can smile with the money, that's happy money. And also on the other end, if you if the money, when you spend money, and if you just feel joy and makes you happy, that's also happy money. So when you write checks and pay bills and still keep smiling, that's happy money.
Now, I can imagine that the biggest yeah, but our listeners mm-hmm. will have is, yeah, but I don't have any money, so I can't be happy about it. To what do you say to them?
Right. So happy money doesn't really matter if you have so much or so little, because it's your relationship with money. I've met and I have interviewed many millionaires and billionaires in my career as an author. I have found many unhappy ones. And at the same time, among those who are struggling financially, I found some who are doing well emotionally because they receive money with happiness and also spend money with happiness.
You write about money IQ and money EQ. IQ is the more tangible stuff, like earning money, uh-huh. protecting money, right. all that. That kind of makes more sense or is easier to understand. What is money EQ?
Money EQ is your emotional health. I've seen stories, and I'm sure you have too, many very intelligent people, you know, who are running hedge funds and all those people, make stupid mistakes emotionally, and they could lose them all. And why does that happen? It's because those people had high money IQ, but very low money EQ. So unless you have a good relationship with money, your life could be miserable. So it doesn't really matter how much money you make, because your spending habits would also increase all the dollar amount you spend. So unless you have control over money emotionally, your life will stay miserable.
And how do you do that? What are some ways in which one can increase one's money EQ?
That's a very good question. I had a mentor whose name is Wahei Takeda, and he passed away, unfortunately, a few years ago. He's a dear mentor of mine, and he's called Warren Buffett of Japan. He was one of the wealthiest man in Japan. And when I became a student of his teaching was very simple and zen. He said, the secret of happy money is arigato in, arigato out. That means when money comes in, you say thank you to the money. And when money goes out of your life, also thank money again. So arigato in, arigato out. Thank you, money in, thank you, money out. So that is a very, very basic mantra that I can give.
You have a number of what I would call contrarian statements in your book. And I love them because they're quite thought-provoking. One of them is, don't save money out of anxiety. What do you mean? I mean, a part of me is like, Ken, don't say that. I don't care why people save. If they're saving out of anxiety, that's fine. At least they're saving.
Right, right. Because, you know, what you focus on grows. So once you start saving out of scarcity mindset, you just feel scared. So say you have saved $5,000 and you feel more scared because maybe I need more. So you reach $10,000, $100,000 and $1 million, still you feel scared because you focus on anxiety. And on the other hand, if you start saving money with joy, that one day this money will make my kids happy, my parents happy, my friends, my family happy, and then the money grows out of joy. But if you just do that out of scared feeling, it just increases your anxiety. So I don't mind, I'm not against saving. Actually, I encourage people to save more, but you have to do that. You'd better do that out of joy, not scarcity.
Second statement, likable people attract money. Are you saying this is just a popularity contest?
Yes, in a sense, because just think about two florists, one who does it because it's her work. The other, who does it with so many beautiful smiles and happy feelings, and he or she does it for fun. You can see it, you can feel it. Which florist do you want to go to? So the happy ones and popular ones always win. So we tend to be attracted by those who are enjoying what they do. And it seems like you're having so much fun, right? And the people who do work out of joy, they get the popular vote. That's what I think.
Yeah, well, I do enjoy what I do. So you're right mm-hmm. on that. You also talk about achieving a state of maro. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that correct. M-A-R-O. Uh-huh. What is mm-hmm. that?
So that's what my mentor, Wahei Takeda, used to teach us. Maro is an abbreviation of the word magokoro. That means sincerity. If your heart is full of kindness, gentleness, which we seem to lack in this world, people will be attracted to you. And the more good you do in the world, the people see it and people react to it. So, we are going to a different times where kindness and gentleness count. And it didn't used to count, last year or a few years ago. But now after COVID, I think people are beginning to realize that we need to be connected. We need to be paying more attention to us.
I am a deep believer in the broad themes that we have talked about thus far. And mm-hmm. there is a level at which people need to engage in the super boring, tactical, to make sure their bills are paid on time, mm-hmm. which is something that is increasingly difficult for millions of people all over the world, given mm-hmm. what's going on all over the world. What perspective can you bring to the boring minutiae that people need to do? I mean, it sounds, on the one hand, all this sounds highfalutin and airy-fairy and ephemeral mm-hmm. when it comes to, you got to pay your credit card bill.
Yes. So right now, we are going into a little bit of scary time because all of us are having some kind of troubles. And I think it's just guiding us toward codependency in a good way. We have to ask for help for one another, and I'm encouraging people, those who have more than enough, you can share what you have with the financially challenged people. And it's not government work, it's us. So if you have more than enough, and if you are willing to share what you have, you feel more satisfaction out of sharing what you have. And for those who are struggling, you have to be willing to ask for help. And this is a time that we have to help one another more than ever. So it's not, I'm not saying anything politically, because, what government should or shouldn't. I think it's more up to us, as individuals. If you have enough, more than enough, you can start helping your brothers, neighbors, your friends. That way, I think we can get through this. And this seems to be the only way, because the government can't keep issuing all the bills. That is not sustainable.
The other dynamic in our culture that people are dealing with, and this was before the pandemic and it will continue long after the pandemic, is just mm-hmm. how sophisticated corporations are at separating mm-hmm. us from our money. We can order something, it will be at our doorstep within 12 hours. They right. follow what we watch or what we want. And the level of sophistication pushing us to spend outside our means is growing every single day. What mm-hmm. advice do you have to an individual to deal with all the marketing and the availability of credit and all the stimulus that has us behave in ways that are counter to what's best for us over time?
So if you're struggling financially and if you have a need to make both ends meet, you have to ask yourself, am I not overspending? And we are. So For those of you who have a hard time making both ends meet, I'm challenging you. Next time when you're going to spend money, ask yourself, is this really, really, really necessary for my survival? And most shoppings, you know, it's not essential. You know, we don't need another sweater. We don't need another gadgets. We don't need any another thing, you know, for our basic survival. So you have to really know the difference if it's a luxury thing or if this is essential for my survival. And we are so brainwashed to have that we need more and more. I think it's very common in Western society, you know, I think half of Japan is that way, but half of Japan is minimalist, you know, Zen type of mentality that we live with the minimum resources. And we don't have to do that, but we need to do that when we need to make both ends meet.
Fascinating stuff. Ken, thank you so much for joining us and for providing your insight. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Bruce. You've asked the best questions ever, and
excellent.
I really enjoyed being interviewed.
Excellent. Excellent. And I wasn't trying to be likable, but I hope that I am. I hope that I am.
Yes, I bet you're so popular in North America. So I'm so honored. I feel so honored, and thank you. This is a great way of starting my day.
Thank you so much. Ken Honda's book is called Happy Money, The Japanese Art of Making Peace with Your Money. He joined us very, very early from Tokyo, Japan.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
The internet has been the place for retail investors to bat around investment ideas for going on like 20 years. It's been a long time. In this most recent speculative boom, it has been sites like Twitter and Reddit that have hosted most or many of these conversations. But how do you capture those conversations and how do you use them in a way to help you invest profitably? It's not easy. There's something called buzz indexes, and it uses social analytics, it uses artificial intelligence to create investment insights. And that's the focus of this conversation. Joining me now to talk about the process is Jamie Wise, founder of Buzz Holdings. Hi, Jamie.
Hey, Bruce. How are you? Thanks for having me.
What is the buzz index?
The buzz index is the benchmark measurement of broad investor sentiment across large cap US equities.
And how do you determine what is in that universe? Because we talk about indexes on the show all the time. There's the S&P 500 index. There's the, more recently, the Bitcoin index. There's tons of indices out there. How do you determine what's in and what's out for Buzz?
Sure. So we launched the Buzz Index, what feels like way back now, in December of 2015. And a key component of determining a stock's eligibility to potentially get into the index are two factors. The first is we only care about large cap stocks, and we define that as stocks with a market cap of $5 billion or greater. And the second, maybe even more important factor, is we care about how these stocks are being discussed across these various online communities. Specifically, we care that these stocks exhibit a wide diversity of conversation, a breadth to the conversation, and that they're being discussed consistently. And we use a measurement period to define that of about a year's worth of conversation.
How do you determine which the buzzy stocks are and how much weight you give to the conversations that people are having about them?
Right. So we look across, you know, all social platforms where we see people talking about stocks. And primarily there are two key platforms where most of the conversation occurs. Those platforms are Twitter, as you talked about earlier,
yep,
and StockTwits. So StockTwits is the community of active investors collaborating and engaging and talking about stocks. And that platform has been around for a little over 10 years now. We look at those platforms along with other platforms, whether they be, you know, financial related like Seeking Alpha or Yahoo Finance, blogs, anywhere people are commenting on stocks, and we treat everyone equally. What we're measuring here is the aggregate level of sentiment, the collective conviction that the broad investment community has with respect to large cap US equities, and specifically the eligible universe of equities that we focus on.
I mentioned artificial intelligence. Can you give me an example of how that works? So is the massive computer interpreting the tone with which commenters are commenting, or how does that actually work?
That's a great question. And it feels scary when you use words like artificial intelligence. But really, the branch of computer science that we apply is something called natural language processing, which many people will put as a subset of artificial intelligence. But essentially, it's an algorithm that is specifically trained to understand certain types of text, of spoken text or written text in this case. Think of it much like language translation when you go to Google Translate. That language translation model works really well today because it's evolved from a simple dictionary-based approach where it looks at one word and then translates it to another to something that understands context because Google has been able to train their models with millions or billions of different examples of speech from one language to another, and the model can start to identify the patterns and the nuances of the conversation and deliver a better result. What we do within Buzz Index is we've developed our own natural language processing models, but instead of training them to do language translation, we've trained them to understand the conversation around stocks. And people speak very differently about stocks than they would about a consumer brand experience or a trip to a restaurant or a vacation. There's very specific language, very specific emojis that those of us in the finance world, we can read these posts and very intuitively understand whether that individual was speaking positively or negatively about that stock as an investment. But we had to train the models to be able to interpret that data the same way we do.
One of the things that will excite and horrify our listeners is going into some of these chat rooms and following these conversations. And I say horrify because the language that is used and the positions that some of these retail investors are taking just makes, they freak me out. How would you define who your customer is? And does it include the people who are playing the game like they're playing the slots in Vegas?
Yeah, I think, you know, some of that more, let's say, colloquial conversation that you're referring to happens more frequently on platforms like Reddit, where it's, you know, a single focus of a stock and it's a supercharged attitude towards that stock. And the conversation and language used around that reflect that. So if we look at the conversation that happens on platforms like StockTwits and even Twitter, the conversation is much more tailored to conventional financial discussion. It's less supercharged. People are on those platforms to share their ideas, to hear from the community, to test their research thesis, and to get engagement. It's very much like a giant dinner table or water cooler. The same way that we're used to talking about stocks in our smaller communities, these platforms really allow for much broader diversity of opinion, much broader conversation, and to us, much greater insight.
How do you think about time these days? And I ask because GameStop was a $40 stock, and then it was a $483 stock, and it is again a $40 stock. How do you think about the speed with which the market is moving, how fast people move in and out of those conversations, and the momentum that these stocks experience?
That's a great question, Bruce. And the thing with sentiment to consider is sentiment has its own time horizons. And sentiment can be used to try and identify very short-term or high-frequency trading strategies or trends, or it can be thought of from a longer-term perspective. And when we created the Buzz Index, our view was that it wasn't to try and create a short-term trading strategy or to try and quickly identify a trend happening online that we could capture and then profit from. That's a trade, not really a theme or a factor. And sentiment to us is much more of a factor. So the way we think about sentiment from a time perspective is consistent with how the index behaves, which is a monthly rebalance. So every month we're really looking at the conversation over the last month, and then in aggregate, identifying those stocks that have the highest conviction levels, the highest degrees of positive sentiment, and those are the names that could be included in the Buzz Index. So those short-term phenomena names like a GameStop, which never met the $5 billion market cap threshold and would never have been eligible to get into the Buzz Index, they have very little influence because those are fleeting sentiment moments and the attention is drawn to it very quickly, and then it withdraws very quickly. And that's one of the reasons I mentioned earlier, as part of our qualification within the eligible universe, we care about that consistent breadth and diversity of conversation over the past year. Because a name that just spikes up for a day or two and then goes away, that's not indicative of really longer-term sentiment trends.
Right. It literally is a flash in the pan. Jamie, thank you for your time. It's fascinating stuff. I could talk about it for hours, but thank you for joining us, and good luck with what's next.
Thanks so much. Enjoyed the conversation.
Jamie Wise, founder of Buzz Holdings. Take a search for Buzz Indexes. It's a really cool idea. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, online money courses in these times. There are thousands out there. How do you pick the right one? Personal finance expert Leslie Ann Scorgi will be here. And later, family lawyer Russell Alexander will be here to talk about his book, Everything You've Always Wanted to Know About Divorce. If you have missed an episode of Moolala, super simple. You can go to our website, moolala.ca, and listen to full episodes. But you can also go into the search bar and look for topics that are of particular relevance to you. And you can go to any of the podcast platforms out there, Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, whatever. And while you're downloading the full show, maybe, just maybe, you want to write a review or subscribe. How cool would that be?
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
We're doing everything online these days, weddings, funerals, schools, and more, learning about money. Joining us now to talk about a growing trend and to take us through how you can find the best course for getting better at your personal finances is Leslie Ann Scorgi. She has been, like me, she's been around in this space for a while. Leslie Ann, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk about this awesome and growing appetite for financial education. It's so great.
What's hilarious is you did not offer courses online prior to the pandemic. MeVest, your firm, had what seems so quaint now. You actually saw people like in person. When did you know you were going to need to, cliche alert here, pivot?
So the pivot became extremely clear to me, like I think it did for so many business owners who were in an in-person model. Like for me, it was near to the end of last March where I had to take a breath and ask myself, is it time to take what I have been teaching and what I've bottled up into my business? Is it time to take this online? Because I don't know exactly how else to reach people. Certainly there's like Zoom and Google Chat and other ways you can offer in my business money coaching. But the other thing I have to share with you, Bruce, is at the beginning of the pandemic, when, you know, everything was breaking loose, people were losing jobs. In the course of 6 weeks, I received 18,000 messages via email, direct message, comments on posts asking for help. And I, you know, it was like around mid-April where I thought, Leslie Ann, you got to do something. You're a leader in this space. And for that, I'm so grateful that people even consider me that. But that's when I pivoted. That's when I said, well, why the heck not? I'm going to just try it out and see who shows up. And if they show up, you know, are they coming with a full heart? Do they really want to learn about money? And the answer is yes, they do.
Yes, they do. Now, so all that to say, you're not an objective observer of this phenomenon. You have skin in the game. And that's in fact why I want to have the conversation with you, because you know the market so well. Are there like 14,000 online money courses available right now? I've lost track.
There are thousands of them, and there's everything from basic budgeting, how to do that online, to how to invest, to how to get yourself into cryptocurrency, like you name it, there's a course for everything. And you know, that is definitely in response to this growing appetite. People want to learn about money. Like when the pandemic hit, we all were at home wondering, well, we can't spend any money, so I guess it's a good time to learn how to save money. Oh, wait, I don't actually know how to do that. So maybe I should look for some resources to help me. And then you go down the rabbit hole of looking for these courses, and there's just so many of them to choose from.
So I have audited one of your courses. And I know you as a human, so I have a sense of your style and your approach. But what do you think people should think about in determining which courses are a fit?
First and foremost, you have to ask yourself, why are you there and what do you actually need? So you probably do not want a one-size-fits-all money course, because you know this, money is just too broad, too big a subject. So think about your most pressing needs. Are they to become a better budgeter? Or perhaps you want to be more empowered with your investment selections. Or still yet, you might not have any idea on how to establish a will or apply for insurance. So think about your most pressing needs. And you know, I got to just call this out. Sometimes you don't know what you don't know when it comes to your needs too. So I would say, you know, talk to a few others who've maybe who you admire as doing a good job with their finances, and ask them, you know, where did you start? Like without telling you exactly where to go, I would say a lot of people start with some basic budgeting and also debt management. And then they kind of graduate up to, you know, how to save and invest more effectively.
You have long been an experimenter in trying different things, and you're very entrepreneurial in nature. What have you found works most effectively in delivering this material online? Are you synchronous? Are you asynchronous? Is it all about the chat? Do you pre-tape the videos? Tell us a bit about the pedagogy that you have found to be most effective.
So it has everything to do with knowing your market. So I know my market because I've had years to grow with them. And I also know where they are. So for me, it was absolutely a no-brainer to meet these wonderful people on Facebook. So that's where we get the greatest engagement. And we've used every kind of technology that Facebook offers to help with what we call social learning. So we've used things like groups and live videos. We've also used some pre-recorded videos. And, you know, when you stitch this all together and you ask for feedback from people in your community, they'll tell you exactly how they want to learn. It's funny. You know, if you just ask, it's a no-brainer, because they'll just say, I want it on Instagram. I want it on Facebook. I want it in a live. So honestly, I don't have, I look at my market as it's a combination of showing up live, because their lives are live, so you want to be relevant. But there's also some fundamental things with any business that you can systematize to make, as a business owner, your life a little bit easier. So you can use some pre-recorded materials. You can use templates that you've already built. It's really about knowing your market. And then when you get up to that scale, if you will, which I'm grateful I was able to scale up fairly quickly, given the high demand with my courses, then you start looking at other technologies to help you deliver the education through learning platforms and reminder bots and you name it. There's just so much out there to really help improve the learning quality.
This is not a regulated industry. There are no standards. Yeah. what should someone look for in the due diligence on the financial educators themselves? It's the Wild West.
Like, I agree with you. I was just texting with one of my very best friends a few days ago about this particular issue, right? It's so unregulated. And you know this, like, anybody can make a claim that if they get out of debt, they've become some kind of expert. Anybody can actually call themselves a money coach or a financial counselor. So what I encourage people to do is actually look at your educator. Go on their website, find out, you know, what kind of background do they have? You know, have they taken their securities courses? Have they taken their CFP? Are they a reputable source? Like, which media outlets have they published in? Are they an academic? You should be able to see their publications. So what you are looking for in an educator is somebody who speaks your language. Absolutely. So you know, you love their posts on Instagram and Facebook. But then when it comes down to like the details, they actually have a background. And I'm going to give you like an example. It's something that my friend actually coached me on this weekend. She said, Leslie Ann, I think you should be a little bit louder and more clear. And so should the leaders in your space about your credentials. And, you know, I hadn't thought about that because you know this, Bruce, like you and I have spent a lot of years in school learning this stuff, right? Like we went to school to learn this stuff and have subsequently developed brands and reputations around it. But I think because the industry is getting crowded, there's an opportunity for educators to actually just be a bit more clear about, you know, where are your licenses? Did you work at a bank? Have you had any experience preparing plans for people? That kind of stuff.
I want to ask you one last question before we go. What does Money Boss cost and what's the range for courses out there that people should expect?
Yeah. So Money Boss is actually our free group. So people come into Facebook and they join our free group Money Boss. From there, they can select either our wealth course, our Money Boss course, which is pretty basic, basic finances, or they can select our debt crusher courses. So our costs on those range, I'm going to go in that same order, from about $1,000 to $2,000 down to $25 to $35 a month. So it depends on what you want to spend your money on.
Right.
And I will share that courses now on the wealth creation side of things, they start at about $2,000, depending on where you're investing and who you're investing with. They start about there, which if you think about it, and you would know this, like if you go to a financial planner and all you do is have a plan commissioned from them, you're going to, by the end of it, kind of be in the same price point for that. So you're dealing with like really understanding your courses, whether or not they speak to you and they can meet your needs. If they can't meet your needs, obviously don't buy it because it's an investment. And that's the main point. You got to put some skin in the game to make money.
Your website is?
Mevest.ca.
Mevest.ca. Leslie Ann, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Bruce.
Leslie Ann Scorgi is the founder of Mevest. And we were talking about some of the online money courses out there. There are a ton, but please do your due diligence. Stay with us. Coming up later, everything you always wanted to know about divorce. I love and hate that book title. Family lawyer Russell Alexander will be here. But first, the music royalty business. Anthony Bruno will be here from the Royalty Exchange. Do you know you can buy a piece of Drake's royalty stream? It's true. To stay up to date on all things Moolala, I have no music royalties. You can't buy mine. You can sign up for our newsletter. It brings together all sorts of stuff that I've done for CBC Radio, for CityLine, BNN Bloomberg, whatever, whatever. It comes once a month, and I will never do anything with your email address.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
There have been a lot of headlines over the last couple years about artists who sold off or lost control of the rights to their music. For example, the rights to Taylor Swift's first six albums were sold off for $600 million. She says that was without her knowledge. Other artists like Bob Dylan are selling their music rights off proactively. It turns out that there is a whole marketplace out there for investing in music royalties. I had no idea there was such a thing. Royalty Exchange is a platform where musicians and investors can come together. And they recently introduced something called The Exchange. Joining us now to talk more about the music royalty business is Anthony Bruno. He is Director of Communications for Royalty Exchange. He's in Denver, Colorado. Hello there.
Hello. Thanks for having me on the show today.
What is the music royalty business?
Well, that's a broad question, but for our purposes, basically, the royalties are basically the way that anyone in the music business earns compensation for their contribution to a work. What many fans may not realize is that there is a whole host of people who contribute to the creation of the music that they listen to, and all of them earn royalties in exchange. And what's happening now, as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, is that many of them are beginning to sell either all or a portion of those royalties to investors to basically generate some upfront cash that they could use to invest in other things or invest in their career while still keeping control over the rights that they have.
What has changed in the last couple years that has this be even something that we're talking about? I mean, back in the day, if it wasn't the artist, maybe it was, I don't know, the label. But now there are just so many different ways in which someone can participate in a royalty stream.
Yeah, that's a good question. So previously, you had to be sort of an industry insider to gain access to royalty deals, right? These things did happen. There were some very large institutional investment in certain music companies backing certain music publishers and whatnot by like actually a Canadian public pension fund, I think for teachers, I believe it was.
Yeah.
Had supported one of the larger publisher institutions at the time. But it was rather restricted. And so a couple of things have happened over the last few years, one of which, not to put too much credit on ourselves, but we did launch and opened it up to basically any investor, and any retail private investor, high net worth individual had the ability to review and buy directly from artists who were looking to sell a portion of those royalties. So that was sort of the first early step. And then more recently, what you've seen are some larger public funds who have gone public to raise money and then use the money they raise to buy far larger catalogs, such as some of the ones that you mentioned earlier, which then you can buy a share of that company, like a stockholder, mm-hmm. and then earn from those royalties basically through a dividend that the company distributes. You're a few steps away from the revenue stream in that model, but it's another way of getting into it. So those are the two things that happen. And then I guess, lastly, what you're seeing is on the investor side, you've got this very low yield environment, as I'm sure you and your listeners are familiar with, where it's a little bit harder to put your money into relatively lower risk yield generating opportunities. And music royalties, while sort of sexy and fun from a first glance perspective, when you really break down the fundamentals of the investment, they're very, very solid. So for an investor who's looking to put their money into potentially double digit yield opportunities, this becomes a very attractive investment very, very quickly. So those are sort of the main areas that sort of developed over the last few years.
I mentioned the exchange. How does it work? I've been on the site. I see that Drake's In My Feelings is on there, but tell our listeners how it actually works.
So there's two parts to our marketplace. The first and the original was basically the auction house. These were basically timed auctions, and a seller, someone who owned royalties, would list their catalog. We'd have an auction. We'd announce it. You'd register for the auction. You'd place bids over the course of the auction. And at the end of that auction, the highest bidder would win and own that royalty asset. We still conduct those. The exchange is a broadening of that in two ways. One is that any investor who previously acquired an asset through an auction or otherwise on our marketplace could then relist those assets on the exchange to resell it if they chose to sell after they've collected their returns that they've liked, basically. So that was sort of the beginning of it. And then more recently, we added the ability for artists to directly add their catalogs to the exchange as well, should they choose not to conduct an auction. This way, they can set the exact price that they're willing to accept for their catalog, and investors can review both the direct listings or the previously owned listings and just sort of, I guess, more tactically make offers with very specific price levels that they're comfortable with without the timed auction and sort of back and forth bidding that you would see on the auction side.
So for an investor, how do they think about return?
Well, return all is based on how much you pay, right? So I think what you're looking at is that how do you actually value a music royalty? And I think the misconception is that, if you know music or if you like the music or if you like the artist, you're going to pay more. And that's actually, you probably would pay more, but it doesn't mean you necessarily should pay more. So one of the things that we've done is that we've tried to package these listings into easily comparable assets. So for every time you go into a listing, you're going to see the same information, regardless of the genre of the music, or whether you like the music or not or anything like that. You're going to be able to tell how old is the music, for how long has it been earning royalties, from what sources do those royalties generate, what is the trend rate of earnings over the last 3 years. And you could use those quantitative metrics to compare listing to listing and decide where you want to place your investment. You don't have to know a thing about the artist or the music at all to make a smart investment based on the way that we package these.
With a traditional, I don't know, exchange traded fund, you've got history and you've got sort of market benchmarks for how, what return you could expect over the course of long periods of time. You know, people would say the equity markets return between 5% and 7%, for example. What would be a comparable in the world of music? I have no idea. I don't even know if you think about it in terms of an annual return.
We do look at returns. In fact, we every 6 months, we take a look at the returns that people, that a number of the investors that participate on our marketplace have enjoyed over the prior timeframe. We are able to monitor some of this based on the fact that we help administer the ongoing royalties that that they collect, not for every single type of asset on the marketplace, but for a good number of them, and enough to make some analysis around that. And so most recently, what we've seen over pretty consistently over the last six and actually the last 12 months is you're seeing around, if you blend it all together, around a over 10% return that that they're collecting. In some cases, it's far more. In some cases, we've seen like 16%. We've seen some that can go far beyond that based on whether or not they sell after collecting royalties for a while, then sell at a premium. Those are one-off situations. But generally, on average, regardless of the kind of asset you buy or for the term that you're buying, you're seeing a blended average of around 10%, a little bit more than 10% returns.
And is that because you're buying a piece of the revenue that would come when someone streams it on Spotify? I mean, this is not the physical sale of vinyl or a CD anymore.
Well, see, that's where it gets into the more complicated part, which I'll try not to get too deep into, but basically—
Two sentences.
Yes, you are able, in most of the assets that are available on our site, you will be generating royalties from the streaming of music on Spotify, but that's not the only source of royalties. However, we feel that streaming is where the tailwind of the industry is. It's really what's driving most revenue in the industry. So if you're buying royalties that predominantly earn from streaming, you're likely to have a better chance of collecting more royalties in the future.
It's fascinating stuff. Anthony, thank you for joining us to talk about it today.
Great. Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Anthony Bruno is Director of Communications for Royalty Exchange. We were talking about the music royalty market, and they've got this product called The Exchange. It's a platform. You can go and invest in the artists that you love, but don't use that to blind the investment potential just because you're a big Drake fan. Stay with us. Coming up next on the program, Russell Alexander's book, Everything You've Always Wanted to Know About Divorce. If you're looking for some books that are more focused on personal finance, listen, I've written a couple myself. Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things With Their Money and What You Can Do About It is available at your local library. It's available on Amazon or Indigo. We talked to Leslie Ann Scorgi on the show today. She has many books over many, many years. She's quite an accomplished author, so check her stuff out too. If you've got a money question that you would like us to answer on this show or in the course of a segment, please send an email to ask@moolala.ca. ask@moolala.ca.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Divorce. How's that for a cheery topic? It can be challenging. It is emotional. There are many financial considerations to make when filing for a divorce. And well, it isn't my top topic to talk about. It is so, so important. So we're going to do that today. Russell Alexander is the founder of Russell Alexander Collaborative Family Lawyers. He's here to talk about his book, Everything You've Always Wanted to Know About Divorce. I got to tell you, Russell, I don't want to know anything about divorce. In fact, I'd like to remain happily married forever and always. But
is it a good topic to avoid?
Yeah, but there are things one should know, even by background, for those of us happily married, and then for those who are in this process, it's incredibly important. If a new client were to read your book cover to cover, how much could they save in billable hours?
in billable hours? That's a great question. Probably at least 50%.
50. Wow.
You can learn a lot. What lawyers do spend a lot of time doing is educating their clients, managing their expectations. We talk about that in the book. So you're going to come to the table at least knowing the language that the lawyers are using, having a basic understanding of some of the concepts that the lawyers deal with every day. And so I think you'd be much further ahead by reading the book. Great
point,
Bruce.
Well, that's one of the things that I noted was how specific it is, and it answers off the top so many questions that you must have to answer 12,000 times. I want to start with how you would define the role of the lawyer. And I mentioned the word collaborative in the name of your firm. That is not in the name of every single family law practice out there. So what does it mean in this context?
Well, first of all, the role of the lawyer is to help clients and parents manage their expectations. Obviously, we're going to inform people of their legal rights and obligations. And then we're going to design a process to help you get from start to finish. So the lawyer is going to ask you about what your goals and interests are, and then help you design a roadmap to obtain those goals and interests. When we look at things collaboratively, we work at a peaceful resolution with respectful communication, working outside of the court system to tailor a resolution that's going to be custom made to you and your family.
For some people, they hear the word collaborative and they go, yeah, like I'm signed up for that. Let's do that. And for other people, especially beginning this process, they may say, no, no, I want the person who has the nuclear warhead that they are going to aim at my soon to be ex-spouse. How do potential clients determine what type of lawyer is going to be a fit for them?
Well, the first thing I would say is if you're looking for retribution or the Shakespearean pound of flesh,
yeah,
the family court's not going to give you that. Hmm. We have a no-fault system. You may be upset at conduct during the course of the marriage. Your spouse may have cheated on you. You may have felt mistreated. The court's not going to revisit the events that occurred during the course of the marriage. It's a very mechanical process. There's no fault. We look at the assets, we look at the debts, and then we look at the best interests of the children. So once you get an understanding of that, then this nuclear option, you're going to understand you're just going to be shooting yourself in the foot. You probably spend a few $100,000 on legal fees. That money could be spent on your children's education or taking a holiday when this pandemic's over. So I think you'll start to manage your own expectations and look for a realistic solution after you get some good advice.
Yeah, it is an expensive process, probably even as simple. And the best cases are not free. How do people keep the costs down?
Well, buying the book is a good first step. A lot of people think they can find an agreement on the internet or these table kitchen agreements. Lawyers love those because it creates more work for us. If you do a kitchen table agreement 2 years down the road, one party might not like it. Then they go to court to set it aside. Then you spend 2 years arguing over the agreement that you did improperly. And then that's when the lawyers get called to come in and fix the problem. So the first tip would be hire a family lawyer, get some realistic advice, and follow that lawyer's advice. The lawyers want their clients to settle their cases quickly. They're happier clients. They pay their bills. These files that drag on for years, nobody wins, not even the lawyers.
There are many elements of this that are one and done, like the division of assets, for example. But there are other elements, like support in various forms, that can continue on for a very long period of time. What are things that get considered in terms of how those amounts are set?
Well, it's tough during the pandemic because lots of people have lost their jobs. We've lost, you know, the restaurant industry, the airline industry. There's lots of families that are suffering. Support is really just a snapshot in time. Child support is easy. We look at what one parent's making. We adjust it each year. That parent's income may go up and down. So a court order or the agreement will have a mechanism for adjusting support pretty much automatically. Spousal support is a little bit more complicated. Lots of factors go into a spousal support order. The length of the relationship, the age of the parent, whether there's children, whether somebody's suffering a disability, whether somebody can reenter the workforce. So lots of factors go into a support order, and they can be looked at. Usually they're subject to a review or a termination date, or somebody may agree to a fixed term of support for life. Every family's different.
What is the single biggest tip you would have to help clients resolve their come to an agreement before they head to the actual court system? And I ask because from a financial perspective, I can only imagine how much more expensive it is if you have to go to those lengths.
Right. So I view court as the default option. It's really the place you go to when you have a spouse that's not going to play nice in the sandbox. They're not going to produce their financial information, or they're going to make unreasonable demands. At that point, then you need a judge to make an order. All other matters, Bruce, can be settled outside of the court system. Excuse me. You can have a separation agreement dealing with everything. And then when you want to get a divorce, the terms of your separation agreement can be filed with the court, made part of your divorce order.
And what's the tip then to have people go that path? Do you like, can you serve them some boozy cocktail to convince them to settle prior to moving to that next step?
Ideally, you get professional help. So a lot of lawyers now use social workers and financial planners in structuring a divorce settlement. Mm. So the social worker can help with things such as parenting time, communication, extracurricular activities. All these items can be dealt with by a parenting coordinator. The lawyers would review the parenting plan and then put it into a formal agreement. Same with the finances, Bruce, and I know you're big on the finances. Mm-hmm. Most traditional negotiations have both lawyers preparing document briefs and financial briefs and then arguing about what items are missing. If you work cooperatively or collaboratively, the parents can choose one financial neutral to assemble the document brief for both lawyers. You're not duplicating work. You're saving time. You're saving expense. So bringing in these third-party neutrals really end up saving a lot of money in the long run.
I joked off the top about how much you could save in billable hours by just reading the book. It is very, very step-by-step. What are the parts, or maybe even one part, that you find yourself having to go over again and again and again and again, and you wish you could just record your voice and make people play it for themselves before they come and see you again?
Well, obviously, during the pandemic, we had a lot of issues with parents doing self-help or trying to take the matters and through their own hands. So Bruce, that could be somebody who's had an access visit with their child who simply just doesn't return the child, or they're trying to use the pandemic to gain an advantage. They'll complain maybe their spouse is a first responder or healthcare worker and poses a risk to the child. So we've seen a lot of that. And essentially what we want to do is maintain as much normalcy for the children as possible. So the parenting agreement or schedule that you had prior to the pandemic should continue unless there's exceptional circumstances. So that's sort of been a theme we've seen over the last year. And it's, we have to remind people, you can't just do self-help. Court orders are not a suggestion, they're an order. They're designed to be followed, even during a pandemic.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Russell. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Bruce. Appreciate you having me back.
Russell Alexander, founder of Russell Alexander Collaborative Family Lawyers. And we were talking about his book, Everything You've Always Wanted to Know About Divorce. That is our show for today. If you'd like to stay up to date on all things Moolala, our newsletter is a great way to do that. You go to moolala.ca, you sign up for the newsletter, and once a month you get info about what's going on in this universe. I am also the money columnist for CityLine. So if you'd like to watch some of those segments, cityline.tv is the URL for that. I am at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Facebook, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Instagram. Well, technically I am on Instagram. I'm just the worst Instagrammer in Canada. Thank you so much for joining us, and have a great day.
Bye.